getting things underway this afternoon. Happy to welcome back to the show one of our favorites, talented writer, author of a couple of great baseball books, Stars and Strikes and Big Hair and Plastic Grass. Dan Epstein joins us. Dan, good afternoon.
Hey, Rich. How's it going?
Outstanding, thanks. How are you today?
I'm doing all right. It's actually pretty pretty summery down here in Greensboro, North Carolina. So I'm digging the first day of summer scene.
Yeah, it sounds like it's probably a little bit better than what we've got here. Well, a lot going on. I want to start with your thoughts on a movie that's gotten a lot of buzz lately, the new Scorsese take on the legendary Rolling Thunder review of Bob Dylan. You saw it. What do you think?
You know, I got to be honest, I thought it was kind of a mess, which I suppose makes a certain kind of sense given how much of a mess the Rolling Thunder tour actually was. But it's a weird mixture of really amazing live footage. I mean, it's some of the best live Dylan footage I have ever seen, just in terms of performance and intensity and you know, just that period was a very interesting one for him, where he, you know, he kind of made this tour comeback with the band in 74, and then he was going out again in 75 and 76 with a real motley crew of musicians, some of whom he'd been playing with on and off for years, you know, old friends like Roger McGuinn and Joan Baez and Joni Mitchell, and then people like Rob Stoner and Mick Ronson as part of his backing band. And it's really, you know, a fascinating and very fiery time in Dylan's musical evolution. So that's all great, but then there's all this kind of talking head stuff, which I believe it's supposed to be kind of Scorsese's homage to Robert Altman, but it doesn't really come off very well. I mean, I think Scorsese's about the most un-Altman director of from that period that you can think of. So there's a lot of people kind of playing other people. There's a lot of kind of shaggy dog stories. There's this whole bit with Sharon Stone talking about how she was on the tour as a, you know, as a young model and, you know, acting as a seamstress for the tour. She actually was nowhere near the tour. It's just, you know, supposed to be kind of a joke, you know, and it's kind of funny, but it just kind of drags on interminably, and really I feel like it kind of detracts from pretty heavily from the music. You know, I would give the film an A for music and footage, and then, you know, a D for all the other crap that's in it.
What's the highlight of the film for you?
Oh, there's this performance of the song Isis, which is just, I mean, I felt like somebody was kicking me in the chest while I was watching it. It was that breathtaking and intense. I mean, it's worth watching. Worth seeing the film just for that sequence.
We're talking with Dan Epstein here on Downtown. Some exciting news about your book, Big Hair and Plastic Grass, an audiobook coming soon, right?
Yeah, real soon. I mean, it's great. I mean, even since before the original book came out in 2010, I had people asking if there was going to be an audiobook version. And for whatever reason, my publisher didn't want to go there. But I was contacted recently by Blackstone Audio, who do a ton of audiobooks, and they not only wanted to do the book in an audio version, but they wanted me to narrate it. So it's coming out next week. You can find it through Audible and Google Play and just about every place else there are audiobooks for streaming. But, you know, if you're really into solid media, there's also a 10 CD box set version that they're putting out. So, you know, I feel like I've made it now that I have a box set.
I love it. I went back and reread the book for, I think it's the third time now. It's such a wonderful book, and a decade that I know meant a lot to you. It did to me as well, because the 70s were such a unique decade in baseball history. And you mentioned in the foreword to the book, there weren't a lot of big, gaudy offensive numbers. You only had one guy hit 50 homers in that decade. And baseball was sort of tailored to those artificial turf stadiums that had cropped up.
Yeah, I mean, I'm, you know, a lot of people misread the book and misread the title as me being in favor of AstroTurf, which I never was. But you have to admit that there was a style of play that a lot of teams began to sort of build their teams based on how baseball was played on AstroTurf. And it was very exciting. It was all about speed and, you know, balls hit down the line that, you know, suddenly, you know, could turn from a single into an inside the park home run. I mean, it was like playing baseball in a pinball machine. And there were so many exciting teams from the time, like the Kansas City Royals and the late 70s Houston Astros, and, you know, and then even the Reds, to a Cincinnati Reds to a certain extent, where it's like, you know, that they had a lot of sluggers on the team, but they also had a lot of guys, you know, that they had great defense, which was very important to have when playing on artificial turf. And, you know, and a lot of guys who could hit, who could make contact and hit for average. And, you know, and while I don't want to see AstroTurf coming back, I do miss the days where, you know, it was about something other than, you know, strikeouts, home runs, or bases on balls.
And we've talked about this with you before. It was also a decade of so many great characters in the game. I would also say, fashion-wise, hideous, but awesome at the same time. Maybe the greatest decade for baseball fashion, both in terms of uniforms, facial hair, you name it.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. I mean, you look back at any baseball cards from the 1970s, especially starting in like 74, 75, and you just see all these guys sprouting the long hair and the mustaches and the uniforms are getting very colorful because, for one thing, the teams have adopted polyester over cotton and wool as a material because it wore better. And then, and that made it easier to make more colorful, to imbue them with more colorful designs. And which in turn, you know, I mean, we don't think about this now because we all have color television, but in the 70s was the first decade where Americans had more color than black and white TVs. And this was, you know, it was very exciting to watch an MLB game on color television, you know, especially something like the All-Star game where you had all these guys wearing the different uniforms. And, you know, it was just this, you know, it was like a fashion show, just like, you know, you've got the Houston Astros with the tequila sunrise. You've got the Pittsburgh Pirates with, like, you know, 30 different combinations of cap, jersey, and pants and socks. And, you know, really most of the teams, with the exception of, say, the Yankees and the Red Sox, and the Dodgers, really got into adding more color to their uniforms. And it was a lot of fun.
I also feel like it was the last decade for great nicknames in baseball.
It really was. I mean, it's, you know, you just go down the line, you know, Al the Mad Hungarian Roboski, Mark the Bird Fidrich, Bill the Spaceman Lee, Mickey, Mick the Quick Rivers. I mean, it's just like on and on. There's like you said earlier, great characters too. Like this was an era where players were feeling more comfortable with being themselves, you know, on the field and in the media. And it wasn't just about sort of towing the line and letting your team's PR guy dictate the sort of things that you should be saying.
We're coming up on the 40th anniversary of one of the most infamous events of baseball in the 1970s. You lived in Chicago for a while. Can you believe that they're going to celebrate the 40th anniversary of Disco Demolition Night, even bringing back Steve Dahl?
Yeah, you know, well, I can actually. I mean, if you lived in Chicago in that period of time, I mean, that was, I moved to Chicago right after that happened, maybe 3 or 4 months afterwards, and still, you know, into 1980, that's pretty much all kids my age were talking about was Disco Demolition Night. And, you know, it's an event with a really complicated, a much more layered and complex background and legacy than people, ascribe to it now. I mean, a lot of people, you know, accuse it as being sort of a racist, anti-black, homophobic, event. And that's not really what was going on with Steve Dahl. It was definitely more about protesting the sort of cultural omnipresence of disco, which was, you know, I mean, by the time Disco Demolition happened, you had, you know, Grandma and Grandpa were taking disco lessons at Arthur Murray, and there were disco fashions at J.C. Penney's, and, you know, and the American record industry was really, you know, going whole hog on disco and just like, you know, just cranking out the product. And, you know, really the American record industry did a lot more to damage disco's long-term prospects, than Steve Dahl ever did. Just by sheer glut of crappy product. And I mean, there was a lot of great disco that came out. I was and remain a huge fan of like Chic and Funkadelic. I mean, they were more funk than disco, but they were moving into that arena at that point as well. But there was a lot of really forgettable product that was, I mean, Ethel Merman came out with a disco record in the summer of 79. How done was disco at that point anyway? So I think it was, you know, a lot of the people who came to that event were there not because they were racist or homophobic. They were there because they wanted to party and see records get blown up, and strike a blow for rock and roll, which also ironically, a lot of the music that they were, you know, that Steve Dahl and the station he worked for, WLUP, were really behind, you know, that sort of classic rock of the 70s, you know, that was kind of running on fumes by then too. And, you know, all these bands like Led Zeppelin, Yes, The Who, I mean, they would all be gone or making, you know, significantly worse records by the end of the decade and into the next.
I know Doc Ellis was one of your favorites. You were featured in the great documentary about Ellis. Have you heard anything new? There was talk for quite a while about Ice Cube making a biopic of Doc Ellis featuring his son. Do you know if that's still in the works?
The last I heard is that for whatever reason, Ice Cube and his son are no longer attached to the project. And I don't know what the workings are behind that. But that's really too bad. I mean, Doc was an incredible character. I mean, obviously he's best known today for pitching a no-hitter under the influence of LSD. But he was also, you know, an incredible competitor. I've never talked to a teammate of his who said anything but great things to say about him. And this was a guy who, after he, you know, left baseball and got sober, did incredible work with, recovering addicts, especially ones, in prison, which is, you know, far and away more giving back to the human race than many players of his era or since have done. So, you know, his is a very inspiring tale, and I hope we do see it, see a Hollywood version of it one of these days, but it doesn't sound like we'll be seeing it anytime soon.
We've got another big music anniversary coming up this summer, a bit before your time and mine, but still one of the landmark events in the history of rock and roll. What's the lasting effect of Woodstock 50 years later?
Wow, that's a good question. I mean, I'm one of these people who tends to believe that it's a little overrated. That, you know, certainly the movie of the concert hasn't held up well, and the, you know, the sort of festival concept made it all the rage for a little while there. You know, I mean, that sort of was already Altamont, just, you know, a few months later, really kind of sounded the death knell for that. I mean, I think Rhino Records is putting out like a massive box set, this summer with, you know, just about every note that was recorded at the concert. And, you know, and I'm sure that there'll be a lot of interesting and worthwhile things on there, but on the other hand, you get like, I think they were trying to make somebody was trying to put together a 50th anniversary Woodstock concert, in or near Bethel, New York, where the original one was,
right.
And the funding's been pulled from that, and I don't think that's going to happen. I mean, you know, it kind of, I guess the lasting legacy in my mind is that it turns the town of Woodstock into kind of a tourist trap, and where you can, you know, still go and buy tie-dye T-shirts and all that. But I think, you know, really, I think the most important music festival of the 1960s was Monterey Pop in 1967. I think that the legacy of that is far more widespread and important to this day than Woodstock ever was.
It's a big day today in the rock and roll world, an important birthday. Ray Davies, 75 years old today.
Yes, I think if I had to pick a favorite all-time songwriter, it would be Ray Davies of the Kinks. Especially the work he did from 1964 to the early 80s is just an incredible run of records and songs and you know, if you made me pick a top 100 of you know, my all-time favorite songs, I would wager that Ray would probably have about 40% of them.
Well, keep your eyes open for the new audiobook edition of Dan's great book, Big Hair and Plastic Grass. Is there an extended disco remix if you get the box set?
That would be amazing. I wish I had thought of that.
Next time, chapter 2, we'll do that. Hey, Dan, it's always great to talk with you. Thanks so much for making time for us. Enjoy your summer and get some beautiful weather and send it our way, please, whenever you can.
You got it, Rich. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you. Dan Epstein here on Downtown. Follow him on Twitter, Facebook as well. Great stuff there. One of the most talented guys in the business.